African Rice Heart, Part 4, Bed 4 of 12.
There's a young mother in bed 4 of 12. She's suffering from a bad bout of malaria and a cough that racks her body. It's what they call a productive cough. It's producing mucus and phlegm, which she spits into a rag and tucks in between the bed frame and mattress. She doesn't cover her mouth when she coughs, and when the sun slips into the window at just the right angle, you can see her cough sending a dense spray whichever way she's facing. She's being looked after by an inconsistent smattering of family members who come in but don't really bring her anything. Her 9-year-old daughter sleeps below the metal bed, all balled up with her hands between her thighs. Some tired nurse ran a blood clot out of the young woman's IV tubing and right onto the ground beside the leg of the bed. It's dried now, and it's got neighboring filth all around, including crumbs of sugar crackers, rat droppings, and rings where puddles of something used to sit. She coughs, and the spray settles on her 6-month-old baby. He resembles her, not in looks really, but in health. However, his cough screams high above the tone of hers. Oh, and his ribs, they clench down over his lungs in an oppressive sort of way. While his bones are probably like anyone else's, they look so much sharper because they're so close to the skin's surface. The bare form looks like a child in a hand-me-down jumpsuit. His skin is way too big for him. The nurse walks over to the IV pole to change the perfusion and clips the baby's foot with her body as she brushes by the bed. She glances over her shoulder, becoming aware of the baby, who's now crying. Perhaps it's because of the way that the mother's arms just lie limply under the baby and her eyes never even look at him, but you'd hardly know that something so valuable belonged to her, much less another heartbeat. She is exhausted and has little strength left to give. Cartwheels. I swung Aaron around by his arms today. It seemed like no one had ever done that to him before. That trick seemed to begin what became stunt time. Everyone in the family had some trick to perform. Some did handstands, some made funny faces, some moved their bodies through these incredible dance routines. And Jolie, she did a cartwheel. This sweet, homemaking African mother, clothed in her traditional African wrap, did this impressive, bent-legged cartwheel. I cheered in both shock and love both. Jolie and I have so many commonalities, and as they're uncovered, I've begun to wonder how many other people who I thought were very different are actually very similar. Jolie and I grew up in 2 very different ways, but we both love cartwheels. Let me take your temperature. Sometimes I think these babies will melt the plastic mattresses they lie on. Their burning, malaria-infested bodies radiate heat to the mothers or whoever holds them. And taking their temperature is sometimes a challenge. Thermometers somehow continually disappear. They often break, too. I've broken a couple glass thermometers myself, and last night there were none left. Stefan, the administrative assistant, said that there were none in storage room either. I wasn't really sure exactly what the best plan of action for my night shift would be, but I decided to take the temperatures as best I could. The next morning, I gave my report to the day nurse. She asked me what yeses and nos were doing in the columns that should have been holding temperatures. I explained that I had to go by touch because there were no thermometers in the house. I felt the baby's chests and heads, and if they felt like they were burning up, I put a yes in the column and ordered the family to bring a wet cloth for the baby. If the baby's body felt like mine, then I'd write no. So often we're short-staffed and short-supplied, but we're trying. We're definitely trying. Bitter defensive. Over and over and over. It happened again. I want to lay this out clearly for you, this situation that seems to play out over and over and over again. A mother and father come to the hospital with an extremely sick child. They pay for the consultation, and the doctor tells them what the child needs to get better. Maybe it's a blood transfusion, medicated perfusion, or hospitalization. The parents say, "We don't have money." That's almost everyone's response because, really honestly, what money they have could easily go to another basic need of theirs. Oil and rice, a t-shirt to alternate with the one they already have, school bills. Most parents have some money, but not much of it. I know that sometimes parents have said that they don't have any money, but then when they see that no one is going to pay for them, they pull money out of their pockets and put it on the table. It's so hard to tell who really needs the money. I'm learning that paying for every child's hospital bill would take away the honorable and appropriate responsibility of parents to take care of their children. It's true. If parents learn that they don't have to take responsibility for their children, that someone else will pick up the slack for them, they could begin to depend on that. But when do we give parents a break when they really don't have money? When do we say, you do need help? Do we just step in when they're about to die of starvation? Do we wait for them to walk out the doors of the hospital because they can't pay and then go running after them and saying, okay, so you really don't have money. Come back in here. It's just so hard to know where to draw the line when everyone is struggling. I was presenting the patients to Dr. Francois, an intern from Togo, during the rounds the other day, and the baby in the first bed was sick with malaria and extremely malnourished. Fever, respiratory infection, vomiting, and dehydration. The doctor took a look at the chart and wrote down what needed to be done, and I explained it to the father. He said, "This is too much. I don't have the money for this. We must go home." Dr. Francois in French instantly laid into him. "You want to leave the hospital when your baby's like this? Do you understand that he will die?" The man said, "We don't have the money." Dr. Francois said, "Do you want your child to get better? Do you? Avoiding eye contact, the man said quietly, "If I had the money, this would be simple, but it's not simple." My heart went out to the man because I really think he was telling the truth. But the doctor was frustrated, I could tell. He sees so many people scamming to get free care at that hospital, people who could just pay but don't want to. The doctor said, "Okay, give me your medical carnet. I'll discharge you if that's what you want." The man slowly handed over his little yellow medical record book. The doctor said, "This is on you. This is not my fault. This is not the hospital's fault. You are deciding to leave. It's your fault." And with that, he wrote the discharge orders for the little boy. The man seemed so sad. He hung his head and frustratedly said, "Yes, I know. I understand. It's on me. It's all because of me." I asked the doctor if I could talk to him. We left the ward and I asked him if he really thought the man actually had money. He said, "Yes, maybe." I said I really didn't think he did. The man was handicapped. His feet were just knobs, having been amputated or malformed at birth. And he was walking with a crutch. His clothes were old, with holes scattered about, and while these things are not sure signs of poverty, they're certainly indicators. I asked the doctor again, "So you really think that he has the money?" He said, "Yes," and I said, "Okay." He went back in, finalized the process of sending the man home with his dying child, and home they went. It still gets me. Was it the right thing to do? Or are we so bitter and defensive that we can't recognize need anymore? It is one of the hardest things about this place. When you hit rock. Isidore chomped on a rock in the rice tonight. In pain, he cupped his mouth with his hand, spit out what he'd been chewing, and shook his head. And the clash of rock on teeth was a nice little prelude to the stream of complaints that came from his mouth then. Everyone turned and pointed to Esther, who had done a poor job of preparing the rice. With grins and chuckles, they commented about her ability to cook. Everyone thought it was funny, everyone except for Isidore. And Esther. She acted sheepish. Esther is generally really confident, but I can tell that she's working to meet her culture's expectations of her as a woman. Girls grow to be women, don't we? I told my brother Fletcher to never use the word woman to call a girl. He said, "But you are a woman." I explained that somehow we girls have been robbed of that word in its original meaning. Woman has a bad feeling to it because so many men have used it to demand things, that their wives bring them food or whatever. What do I want to be called? I don't know. Lady sounds frumpy and girl sounds really youngish. I guess I want the word woman back. And while women here in Chad are fairly dependent on men at times, for money and such, men are also very dependent on women. And being a woman is an incredibly noble thing. Women, they knit society together here. They raise the children here, and they run the marketplace. They care for the sick and provide the meals here. Esther, she's becoming a woman, and I can tell that she wants to serve the family food that has no rocks in it. Sipping and passing. Last night I woke up in the dark with a screaming thirst. It was the same kind I remembered from when I was a kid, when I'd wake up in the middle of the night and be so thirsty that even while half asleep still, I'd walk to the bathroom sink, turn on my faucet, and with my eyes still closed, lap water up from my cupped hands like a puppy. You just do it because your body tells you to, and last night there was no option of going back to sleep. So I climbed out from under my mosquito net, quietly sneaked out of my hut, and shuffled my bare feet over to the well. I found the long rope and followed it to the end where the bucket was, dropped the bucket into the well, and hauled up some water. I can draw up water just fine now, even in the dark. Holding the bucket with both hands, I tipped it back and drank. There was sand on the bucket's lip and now on my lips, and the water tasted like dirt. But just like in those old days when I was a kid, I walked back to my bed satisfied. When I first moved in with this family, I always bottled up water at the hospital and brought it home. The water there is pumped from deep in the ground and doesn't have the gut-turning bacteria called Giardia. The kids knew that I didn't drink water from our open-air well, and I was kind of sheepish about that. I felt like a sissy, really. But I explained it to them in terms of my stomach being wimpy. I said that they had strong stomachs, but mine would revolt. At mealtimes, I'd have this special water, and the kids loved to drink it. Slowly, though, as time has passed here, I've accepted some new normals. Being barefoot is preferable, especially for jogging. The smell of other people's urine while showering is okay. While I'm definitely still careful, blood is less scary. Having a baby wet your lap while holding it is funny, and your clothes dry just fine. Sifting bugs out of the flour and picking them out of bread is no longer worth the effort. Grasshoppers make a fine dessert. Clothes can be worn 2 days in a row, and I drink our well water now. You drink it now, Emily? Your stomach is strong now? The kids ask. We pass wooden bowls of water around at mealtimes, and everyone sips and passes. Dressing changes. When I change dressings on people's wounds, my eyes tense up, my eyebrows angle downward, and my forehead wrinkles in horizontal stripes. We mix a cap of bleach with a jar full of water, and with that we cleanse people's wounds. How the bleach must sting as it sterilizes the tender tissues. I imagine it to be awful. But I know that the pain leads to a healed foot, an abdomen that can carry another baby, or a collapsed lung that will actually hold air again. There's a song by Reliant K that says, "The end will justify the pain it took to get us there." Still, when I stuff stinging gauze into a 2-inch deep hole in the side of someone's leg, I can't always stop my face from taking that shape. Moonwalk. Aaron's head is cozied up on my lap, and Armel can't stop running her hand along my prickly, unshaven leg. Night has fallen, and our energy levels have as well. In fact, Armel's stroking begins to slow down and her eyes lose that look of wonder as she slips out of consciousness. My French is better now. Our conversations can be interesting and even reflect opinion, emotion, or breadth of topic. With so many of us lying out there, it's not often that conversation dies. Tonight, the moon is especially massive. We don't even need flashlights. That big ball of light does a better job. And the moon demands some acknowledgement tonight. "You know someone's walked on that," I say, referring to the bright, rocky surface of the moon. Tony sits up from where he's stretched out and says, "Really? Up there?" And Esther's face speaks for her mouth and tells me that she's never heard that fact before. They ask about humanity's ascent and stroll on the moon's surface. They have a hard time believing me. Education. I've taken it for granted. The sight of children the other night, lying on their stomachs in the dirt around a lamp, with their prize notebooks, teaching each other math, 12-year-olds teaching 7-year-olds. It's not ideal, really, the education system. The schools vary. The public grade school is simply a thatch roof with see-through walls. Inside, the children learn orally while they sit on these mud bricks that lift them maybe 3 inches off the dirt. Education, when you're in a third world village, is something you have to want in order to get. You have to clutch at it. You have to seek it. Reach for it, and even then, you might not get it. By the time that middle-class American children are 10, they know what dinosaurs are and how incredibly large the ocean is. By the age of 13, they know that people need protein and how blood circulates in the body. And by the age of 16, they know about chemical reactions and the speed of light. All along, they learn about world history and local history, and news is available everywhere. And here I am, breaking the news that men have walked on the moon. It's a privilege and a really special moment. Sleepover. Estella is the baby of the family. Her eyes lock onto those of others unapologetically. She doesn't shift them sideways or worry that she might be thought to be staring because, at 7 years old, you're allowed deviations from most social rules. Energy is stacked behind her eyes, waiting for any chance to ignite. And when her eyes find yours, they crease and bend and squint about, and her smile does the same. Then her body starts bobbing, springing from her toes, that soon turns into full-on explosions of her legs, up and down. And somehow, even while she's moving up and down, her eyes never leave yours. And it's not awkward at all. I think this is what joy might look like. Estella's 12-year-old sister, Merci, makes perfect grades at school, exudes confidence, and is more level-headed, often trying to tame Estella's behavior. But from time to time, she herself ditches her maturity and screams loudly or spontaneously contorts her face to get a reaction. Their mom's name is Bridget. She wears her clothes haphazardly, paying little attention to how she dresses, almost like she isn't really trying. Head wraps always sweep her forehead, and long, flashy earrings dangle and distract me when we talk. She's older, but she has that same energy of Estella. Her eyes do that same lighty thing, only they're a bit more controlled. It seems like her eyes have had more experience, have seen more hard things than Estella's have, and that knowledge affects her reactions. Tonight, I came home around 8 p.m., and everyone was spread out on the mats in front of my hut, which was unusual. I never really understand how we decide where to eat the nightly meal. Most of the time, we eat by the cooking corner, but then there are like these random nights when the family spreads their mats out over top of the drying bricks, and we eat there, or the nights where no one eats, or the nights when no one's even home. So when a night like tonight comes and everyone decides to eat outside my door, it catches me by surprise, but I'm not really surprised. There are just hundreds of things that I don't understand. I feel like my family must think I ask a million pointless questions. Why do you drink from bowls when you have cups? Why do you drop coals in the tea when it's done? Where do the boys go during the evenings? Who are the random old people who come and visit but don't say a word? Where does everyone go to use the bathroom when we don't have one in our house? I've never needed to ask so many questions. There's never been so many things that I didn't know. But tonight I didn't even ask why we were eating in a different place because 3-year-old Armel came sleepily over to me, looking very crisp in her newly sewn holiday dress, but quietly complaining that she was cold. She handed me one of Jolie's wraps, a larger piece of cloth, and wanted to be wrapped in it. I tucked one end under her little armpit, and she spun in a circle while the fabric wound around her in tight layers. In this mummified state, she tipped over, flopped down across my lap, which entertained everyone. She fell asleep quickly, and her limp weight cut off the circulation to my feet. She was so cute, though, that I didn't want to move, so my toes went numb. A few minutes later, Ferdinand came running in and said Bridget and her husband were fighting. We all got up and went over to the courtyard wall. Bridget met us there, slightly out of breath. She had run barefoot all the way from her house, and she stood there with her arms crossed, nervously glancing over her shoulder into the dark. She said that her husband was really angry and had hit her, and Estella and Merci were still at home with him. Bridget drinks rice wine every day. It makes her laugh and smell like alcohol. She's never out of control or thoughtless, but she's definitely more free with her words, and she talks close to my face, which is why I know what her breath smells like. Apparently, she had gone to the market and slept there all day long, leaving the kids at home. That's not particularly unusual in Chad, but her husband didn't like it. I'm sure their fight involved an accumulation of other things as well. Bridget's husband told her, "I don't want you anymore." When she told us this, I imagined someone telling me they didn't want me anymore, and despite anything that she had done that might have caused him to feel this way, my heart went out to her. So in my totally broken lingerie, I said, "Bridget, I like you a lot. You can stay in my hut tonight. I have 2 beds. At this, Jolie wrapped me up in a hug and burst into laughter, and so did everyone else. I didn't understand what was so funny. I laughed a little with them, but I was thinking, what? I was serious. I assumed that they were laughing because I was trying to speak Nanjere. I mostly make jokes when I speak in the dialect, jokes about food or boyfriends. I don't often use it to communicate meaningful things because, let's get real, it's a challenge enough for me to communicate meaningful things in French, and I know much less of the dialect than I do French. Brigitte came in and hid with us in our courtyard for a while until Samedi came home. When he got home, everyone pitched in with the details of the story. Samedi's nickname is Papa Sam. I trust him so much because he is one of the kindest and wisest people I've ever met. He gets up and checks our doors 3 times a night to make sure we're safe. He says it's his duty as a father. However, more than just his duty, I sense that he feels things in his heart and acts out of that. He's given me encouragement many times and talked with me about things that have upset me or I don't understand. And it's not just me. He is constantly making peace in the village and taking time for people who come to ask for advice. After hearing the story, Samedi said, "Okay, I'll go talk to your husband." And then he left. He didn't return for a long time, and we got tired of waiting. I told Brigitte that I was going to bed and said that my offer was serious and that she could stay with me for the night. She did. I moved my things off the little cot and she lay down. I tried to give her a blanket, but she said she just needed her strip of fabric. Feeling excited to be hosting a sleepover, I settled onto my cot and got ready to talk. I love to talk at night before I go to sleep. When I was younger, I used to sleep on my older brother Taylor's floor, and I'd talk his ear off. Then, when Taylor grew up, went to high school and college, he was never at home, so I'd sleep on my younger brother Fletcher's floor. I talked his ear off, too. In fact, sometimes Fletcher would say, "Emily, if you're going to sleep in here, you can't talk. I want to sleep." It's just like when I lay down at night, my mind starts up and I think of everything important. So I started talking to Brigitte as we lay there in the dark. She answered a few things and then said, "Okay, Emily, sleep. It's time to sleep." I laughed inside and almost out loud because even when you come to a completely new place, some parts of you follow as if they're attached by a string. A while later, Samedi knocked on my door. He said that he had just talked to Brigitte's husband and that after a lot of convincing, he had decided that he wouldn't hit Brigitte and that he would take her back. Brigitte got up and said that she would go home. When she left, she shut the door behind her and Samedi said, "Emily, you should lock your door." I told him that the lock didn't work from the inside. He said, "What? It hasn't worked all this time? Well, you should put something in front of the door then." And he brought me a brick to put in front of it. Of course, that isn't going to keep anyone out, but I love the fact that they're looking out for me. Josephine, a new patient, started panicking after we got her into bed. She was hollering that there was a dead baby in the room and begging to be moved, her pleas coming out as barely comprehensible moans. Her cornrows were long overdue for rebraiding, and her traditional wrap was faded at each fold, a sure sign that it had been creased in the same way for days. Her hands are always clammy and cold, and her eyes, oh, those eyes, they'll just grab you with their size and then scare you with their yellow tint. Josephine arrived at the hospital in a wheelbarrow with an infected, open ankle fracture. Her ankle had been broken 3 weeks earlier and left totally uncared for. Her good ankle is thin, but this one is swollen with fluid and a mess of infection sits around the bone. She leans towards the reeking foot at all times. I doubt she ever really turns her attention away from that foot during the day. She often says things she doesn't mean and then swings into fits during the late hours of the night. Sometimes, it seems like she's mentally troubled. Other times, it's clear that she just has a lot of life trouble. And still other times, I'm certain she's out to make trouble for the nursing staff. The dead baby was 2 hours deceased, 2 days old, and had been born an unfortunate 2 months too early. The mother had begged that I let her keep the wrapped-up bundle in bed with her till morning, and I half didn't know what to do, and the other half felt sympathy toward her, so I agreed. Obviously upset, Josephine glanced at the baby repeatedly and then pleaded to be moved farther away. No other beds were open, and she was in the one farthest across the room, just about as far from the baby as possible, and I had no one to help me move her anyway. When Josephine couldn't stand it any longer, she, twitching all the way, climbed out of her bed with a nervous rush, completely convinced that she had no other option. She thought that if she stayed in the bed a moment longer, she'd be attacked by the spirits of the dead. Not being able to walk, she scooted herself along the dirty hospital floor, waving her infected foot all in the air. She scooted and moaned, and her bony, uninfected foot made a clean line in the floor as she hauled herself down the hall. She curled up on the cement in the maternity ward and fell asleep until morning. Selfish. I walked out of my hut and sat down on a big root of our central tree while I drank bui. Bui is made from rice flour, rice that's been pounded into this dusty powder. The rice flour and water are boiled together. Jolie sometimes adds goat's milk, sugar, and maybe lime. It's a chatty and comfort food, something you give to the sick people or to children. When they give me bui, they always give me so much, maybe a whole quart or more. No one else gets as much as I do. I always try to get someone to come and drink some of mine, but they always quickly and forcefully decline, saying, "No, Emily, you need to eat all of it." They taught me the word for selfish in Nanjere the other day. It's pronounced lisinya. Now that I know this word, they use it all the time. Right after they bring me a huge bowl, they say, "Oh, Emily is so selfish." And I quickly fight back, "No, I'm not selfish. Here, eat some." I beg them, shoving the bowl towards each of them. But everyone says, "No, no, we know that you're selfish. We can't eat any of your bui." And then they laugh so hard. They frame me every time. There I am with my big bowl all of myself looking truly lisinya. Another phrase that's become such a wonderful source of laughter sounds like this. "Gubba, tukaladuja," which means, "Come on, fight me." Lanky 15-year-old Mundan puts up his stickish arms and then challenges me with this phrase. If I can keep from dying of laughter, I put my fists up and tell him that he doesn't know what's coming. I tell him that I know that he's afraid of me, and then I rub his head with my knuckles. When the kids see us wrestling, they come running, bringing their sharp little fists too. "Gubba, tukaladuja, gubba, tukaladuja." There is so much love growing in this house. Bones angling. I'm looking at a 2-year-old boy who was just diagnosed with TB. He's been sitting for hours on his bed, cross-legged, bones angling all over the place, from his shoulders and his knees, from his ribs and spine. I want to give him food, but he isn't hungry. He barely moves his sad eyes and he doesn't cry. I think he must know that crying takes energy and he doesn't have any to spare. He doesn't lie down, and he doesn't want to sleep. Out of orbit. The days I think about heaven, I feel hopeful for those who suffer and less anxious about all the unrest. I'm thinking about this today because I saw this woman with cancer the size of a basketball in her stomach. Her mat is worn where she's survived on it, surviving for who knows how much longer or in how much more pain. It seems that no matter how many blankets get thrown around the shoulders of all the homeless people or how many dollars get given to charity, this spinning world is just out of orbit, that perfect orbit, and it will be until it's made new. Lord, please make it new soon.
You've been listening to African Rice Heart, a young woman's journal of radical service. It was written and read by Emily Wilkins and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011. Join us again next time on The Bookshelf.